The passage for this morning is going to be found in 1 Timothy, chapter 5. 1 Timothy, chapter 5. I would like to read verses 3 through 16. 1 Timothy, chapter 5, verses 3 through 16. And the title for this message is Caring for Widows. Caring for Widows. And a parenthetical is helping those in need, as I'd like to expand the topic. Before we read, just a few comments. There's an amazing account of a young man who, literally as he was dying, gasping for his last breaths of air, just trying to basically muster all the strength that he had to utter a few words to those that were standing by. And of the few words that he did share, they were directed towards his mother and a good friend of his, that he would take care of his widowed mother. John captures this in chapter 19, verses 26 through 27. When Jesus therefore saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved standing by, he said to his mother, "Woman, behold your son." And then he said to the disciple, "Behold your mother." And from that hour, that disciple took her to his own home. Throughout the Bible, we see the heart of God as rich and compassionate and tender to those who are in need. And in particular, again and again, those poor and needy are identified as the fatherless, the widows, those who can't defend themselves, those who can't necessarily provide for themselves. And I wanted to introduce this message with that scene because it's of all the different commands and all the words that we can read from the law, the prophets, to the epistles, I feel like what John captures there, we can spend a lot of time just on those few verses. But what he captures there, it just kind of, I think, heightens our awareness of the heart of God, in particular towards widows. And maybe just to expand a little bit on this, Jesus is on the cross, and if you get into the physiology of the pain that kind of execution puts on the body, it's horrific. It's insane to even consider that, to go through that. You have these nails through your wrists, messing with those nerves, nails through your feet. And every time Jesus attempted to utter a few words, he'd be pushing with his feet, pulling with his wrists against nails, right? Scraping his back against a rugged cross that's already been beaten to a pulp. And of those words, those few words that he expressed, some, "Forgive them, Father, they don't know what they do," to the thief, "You'll be with me in paradise." But of one thing of chief concern to Jesus was his widowed mother. And he expresses these words for his disciple John to take care of her, and he takes her into his home. At the beginning of this letter that Paul wrote to Timothy, Paul wanted Timothy to set the record straight in terms of a clear, accurate, true teaching against these false teachers that were kind of infiltrating the church in Ephesus. He wanted Timothy to correct all those things that were wrongly taught, correct all those things that were just veering off the course of true doctrine. And we need to appreciate, I think it was of significant concern in Paul's mind that Timothy would teach correctly, that his words would be accurate, that he would lovingly, accurately, truthfully proclaim God's love, his gospel, to the church that he was helping lead. And so I think we can gather from the introduction of 1 Timothy that words are important. What we say matters. What is taught is of extreme importance. But there's a saying, after all is said and done, there's usually more said than done. Words are extremely important. But if there's no actions to follow our words or teachings, if there's no deeds that are seen, right? If there's no acts of service that are visible, then the term hypocrite, I think, is an appropriate indictment. Right? I don't mean to suggest that every time we donate or lend a helping hand that we advertise to the world and say, look at me, and put the spotlight on ourselves. I'm not suggesting that. But I'm just talking about this incongruity. If there's words and no actions, then something is awry. And more specifically, right, if the church teaches, right, if we read Timothy and we see that the church teaches that we should care for those in need, and specifically in this case for widows, and the church doesn't do it, then what does that say about the church? And I appreciate the fact that as part of our reminders, you know, pray for widows and widowers, among many others. I appreciate the fact that at a recent business meeting that there was a significant amount of money provided for quote-unquote needy families. But I think, you know, it always serves as a good reminder for myself, for sure. I'm challenged by this passage, and hopefully you as well, that we'd realize that when we bear the name of Christian, which means to be a follower of Christ, you know, the one who was ridiculed for hanging out and helping the poor and needy, that we too would realize that, yes, an accurate confession of faith is extremely important, but the actions that follow that genuine faith, you know, that's the real validation. And so Paul addresses a particular issue regarding the widows at Ephesus in this passage that we're going to read. And he has some sharp words here. We'll get to those as well. There are those widows who are really in need and in some respects are being neglected. And then there's others who are really not in need and kind of taking advantage of others' generosity. So with all of that, let's read 1 Timothy chapter 5, verses 3 through 16. Honor widows that are widows indeed. For if any widow have children or nephews, or better translated as grandchildren, so if any widow have children or grandchildren, let them learn first to show piety at home and to requite their parents, or to give back in return to their parents. For that is good and acceptable before God. Now she that is a widow indeed and desolate trusts in God and continues in supplications and prayers night and day. But she that lives in pleasure is dead while she lives. And these things give charge that they may be blameless. But if any provide not for his own, and especially for those of his own house, he has denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. Let not a widow be taken into the number under 80 years old or 60 years old, having been the wife of one man, well reported of for good works. If she has brought up children, if she has lodged strangers, if she has washed the saints' feet, if she has relieved the afflicted, if she has diligently followed every good work. But the younger widows refuse, for when they have begun to wax wanton against Christ, they will marry, having damnation because they have cast off their first faith. And withal, they learn to be idle, wandering about from house to house, and not only idle, but tattlers and busybodies, speaking things which they ought not. I will therefore that the younger women marry, bear children, guide the house, and give none occasion to the adversary to speak reproachfully. For some are already turned aside after Satan. If any man or woman that believes has widows, let them relieve them. Let not the church be charged, that it may relieve them that are widows indeed. As I mentioned, this concept of God caring for widows, of his heart dispositioned with a degree of compassion, sensitivity to those who are in need, is revealed throughout Scripture. And I could go on and on with tons of verses that speak to this, but a couple to highlight from different portions of Scripture, just to show you that it is ubiquitous. One reference is Psalm 68:5. This is referring to God. A father of the fatherless, a defender of widows, is God in his holy habitation. Isaiah 1:17, this is God speaking through Isaiah to the people. Learn to do good, seek justice, rebuke the oppressor, defend the fatherless, plead for the widow. James 1:27, pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this, to visit or to care for orphans and widows in their trouble or their distress, and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. And again, there's many other verses that we could read where this heart of God is displayed by either a command or maybe a rebuke for those who are taking advantage of others, or just the expressed heart of God, like for the psalm example. But Paul starts out this passage, as we read, of honoring widows who are really widows. That word honor means the right show respect. It's the same concept of honoring your parents, to give what's due to them. And in this case, I think what's due to these widows is primarily care for them, support for them. And then Paul defines what he means. He says, you honor those widows who are really widows. What does he mean by that? He defines it in the following verses. In verse 5, he says, now she who is really a widow and left alone trusts in God and continues in supplications and prayers night and day. We need to remember the society, the time to which that Paul is addressing here. They didn't have welfare. They didn't have these governmental programs that could help offset or provide for the needs that those are destitute or completely on their own. I mean, there's plenty of countries that still are like that. You know, I don't think in the States we have that problem necessarily so much. I think, in addition, is that more often than not, the husband was the only source of income. And so, as parents got older, right, the expectation was that the children or grandchildren would take care of the parents or the grandparents. But the obvious implication is, if she's a widow, therefore no husband, and no primary form of income, and if there are no children or grandchildren, or if no one's there to actually take care of her, then who's to take care of her? What's she supposed to do? Right? There's no Social Security, no welfare. And I would think that it's not a foreign thought for some of these widows in that time, in that place, that culture, to think, where is my next meal going to come from? I've never had that thought. I have no idea what it feels like to have that thought. But this is the kind of need that we're talking about here. And so Paul describes these widows as being utterly dependent upon the generosity of others. She's left alone. She only trusts in God and continues day and night by asking him to move people to, out of the generosity of their hearts, would support her, provide for her needs. Paul gives an age criterion. He says in verse 9, do not let a widow under 60 years old be taken into the number. Now, I don't think that if a widow approaches the door of the church and she's 59 and a half, that the church is going to check her birth certificate and be like, okay, I'm sorry, but you don't qualify. The Apostle Paul laid out this criteria and you don't meet it. Right? I don't think it's that kind of idea, but Paul is indicating that these are older widows. They're widows who can't really remarry and start a family again. And it speaks, again, to their utter dependency upon others' generosity. So it's not to be taken so rigidly as, whoops, you didn't meet your 60th birthday. Sorry, can't help you. No food or money for you today. But rather, again, it's they're beyond marriage. They're beyond starting a family again. They need help. He also, though, explains a little bit more criteria here with respect to the way the widow lived. He says, continuing on in verse 9, and not unless she has been the wife of one man. What that implies is that she's a faithful wife to her one husband who, you know, has since passed. And then in verse 10, he says, well reported for good works. If she's brought up children, she's lodged strangers, washed the saints' feet, relieved the afflicted, diligently followed every good work. She's a generous, loving person. And I would think that this kind of character, if this is the character that marks the woman while her husband lived and while she actually wasn't a widow, that it would continue. Despite the fact that she is destitute and doesn't have much to give, that same kind of character would carry through, and the little that she does have to give would still be shown in her way of life, despite her widowhood. And so Paul says, like, this is the criteria that we should use so that the church would properly allocate funds to help those that are really, really in need. And so that's part of the reason why Paul lays that out. But the other part is that there are some in Ephesus that are taking advantage of the church's generosity, and it was to the detriment of these who really needed it the most. And so Paul kind of interweaves criteria to the contrary of those that would really need the help. there were some widows, and I want to be sensitive here because I think there was a specific purpose in Paul writing this to Timothy. Actually, if you look at Paul's letters in general, if it's sent to, let's say, a church like Rome, a church they had not visited, it's very general in its teaching, its exhortation, etc. The more specific his audience gets, like maybe in Corinthians, a church that he helped build and grow, there's more specificity with his instruction. And here with Timothy, you know, a son in the faith, someone that he's personally mentoring and teaching in a particular church in Ephesus, there's great specificity. And so we shouldn't maybe get too bent out of shape with what's specifically going on in Ephesus, such that we miss the general principle. That's all I really wanted to say by going through that. And so I don't think Paul is being insensitive to these younger widows who have lost their husbands by writing what he's writing. And not minimizing the pain of still losing your spouse, even in your young age. But there's an issue specifically in Ephesus that he wants to address here. And there are these younger widows who really didn't need this financial support. He says in verse 4, "But if any widow has children or grandchildren, let them first show piety at home and repay their parents, for this is good and acceptable before God." So if there was the opportunity for the widow, whether she was young or old in this case, if she had children or grandchildren who were able to take care of her, let them take care of her. Now, that's priority number one in the family, and not burden the church such that they can help others who are really in need. But then here we get to the more specific aspect of some of these young widows who are just really terrible examples. But she who lives in pleasure, I'll get to that in a second, but she who lives in pleasure is dead while she lives. Verse 11, "Refuse the younger widows, for when they have begun to wax or grow wanton against Christ," that means to live like a carnal, licentious, loose, if I can use that term, life, "and they desire to marry," and I would probably put in there for the wrong reasons, "they have condemnation or their damnation because they have cast off their first faith." And so in addition to that, it says they're idle, they're wandering about from house to house, and not only idle, but they're gossips, they're busybodies. And then Paul says in verse 14, "Therefore I desire the younger widows to marry, bear children, manage a house, so as not to give any opportunity for the adversary to speak reproachfully." Because it seems like they're kind of ruining the reputation of those who bear the name of Christ. And he says, "For some have already turned aside after Satan." So just to kind of expand a little bit on that passage in terms of the specific issue that's going on in Ephesus. "But she who lives in pleasure," that word that's translated as pleasure there appears one other time in the New Testament. That's in James 5:5. The context of James 5:5 is this very sharp rebuke against those who are wealthy taking advantage of the poor and needy. And James writes this, "You have lived on the earth in pleasure," referring to these wealthy people, "in pleasure, in luxury, in extravagance. You have fattened your hearts." And then he goes on. And it reminds me of another verse where these wealthy are rebuked in Amos 4:1. "Hear this, you cows of Bashan." He's not talking about cows, he's talking about women. Not a flattering term. So maybe a modern-day translation, you could say these are kind of like the Real Housewives of Bashan. He says, "Hear this, you cows of Bashan, who were on the mountain of Samaria, who oppress the poor, who crush the needy, who say to your husbands, 'Bring us wine, let us drink.'" It's that kind of selfish, luxurious, extravagant lifestyle that, not necessarily always, but might be a strong indicator that you're spiritually dead. And that's what Paul kind of just puts in a very short phrase. He says, "But she who lives in pleasure is dead while she lives." That's the kind of idea that he's communicating there. When he says in verse 11 that they desire to marry, having condemnation because they've cast off their first faith. He's not condemning marriage, because we can quickly see in verse 14 that he's encouraging marriage. And that's why I kind of put that parenthetical in there, because it seems like they're marrying for the wrong reasons. There's a lot of wrongness about the perspective of these young widows. And the picture that I'm getting from reading what Paul is saying here to Timothy is that they're already well off, and so they're abusing these handouts from the church. And that's to the detriment of those who actually need it. They're spending their days doing nothing, gossiping and meddling in other people's business. And on top of all that, they're living in pleasure and luxury, and it seems to be that they probably were never believers, or maybe seriously compromising their faith. And so Paul instructs them. He says, I want you to find stability, purpose. I want you to find structure and accountability in the context of a family. And then he concludes, after seriously rebuking some of these women in the church of Ephesus, he says, if any believing man or woman has widows, right? If there's a widow in your family, then it's a familial responsibility that you take care of her, so the church isn't burdened, so that the church may relieve those who are really widows. And so the conclusion of the argument is, take care of and support those widows who really have nowhere to turn. And so I just want to broaden this a little bit more, because there's some general principles here that we can apply to our lives. And for the moment, I still want to stick with the topic of widows. Again, that time and place, there really wasn't this government assistance. There probably really wasn't insurance or a significant retirement saved up for the woman. And so for that reason, to be a widow was a seriously bad social situation to be in. You really were dependent, unless you were well off like some of these. But generally speaking, you were dependent on the generosity and the care of other people. And so even though, maybe, and I say this with some hesitancy, but I'll say, comparing our time and culture, I'll say the United States, right, to that time, I think there's a difference. And so I would say that the financial burden of widows is probably not as acute as it was back then, right? I don't think that we would be wondering where our next meal is coming from, like it would be true of them back then. But at the same time, just having food, I mean, super important, obviously, to have food, right? Food, finances, having a roof over your head is extremely important, but I want to broaden that to consider the other needs that a widow needs to have met, the other needs that need to be addressed or cared for. Just reading some other things, kind of brought to mind the concept of maybe the burden of loneliness. Of that kind of burden weighing heavy on the person who has lost their husband after so many years. I've read some things about feeling like you lose a sense of maybe of purpose, maybe kind of you lose your sense of your place in your social gatherings or your settings. I mean, we need to be sensitive to that, and I think active with respect to that need. This June will mark 14 years of marriage in my life. And if I extrapolate that 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, thinking about growing closer and closer to my wife, and I'm thankful that I am, that our marriage is trending in a good direction, right? That we are getting closer and closer. But to extrapolate that line, to becoming more and more one flesh, if I can say that, more and more intertwined in each other's lives, kind of dependent upon one another. And then all of a sudden there's like a cliff and that just all of a sudden gets cut off. I can only imagine the sense of like loneliness and the sense of like, my husband or my wife was always right there next to me when we go to so-and-so's house or to go to church or whatever it was, and that's no longer there. It's like a piece of you is literally removed. And so despite the fact that we might not feel the financial burden so much in our day and age, is kind of aside, right? That was maybe the primary reason why Paul is speaking here to Ephesus, or to Timothy in Ephesus. But there's so much more of a greater need that we can understand and appreciate based upon the general principle of caring for those who are really in need. And so there's a significant emotional burden, I think, that we need to be sensitive to, that we need to maybe recognize, try to put ourselves in that position so that we could empathize and reach out and love and care as needed. Timothy, I want to return to a couple verses in Timothy. Paul says that if any widow has children or grandchildren, let them first show piety at home to basically repay their parents, for this is good and acceptable before God. And then he says this is kind of the sharp tone that he uses in verse 8. But if anyone does not provide for his own, especially for those of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an infidel or an unbeliever. And so there's, even though that the particular topic here is widows, and there's a primary responsibility to the family to care for the widows in their family, you know, we can broaden this to really understand that this is more than just the care of widows or widowers. Right? Paul is saying that if you don't even care for your own family, you're worse than an infidel. You're worse than an unbeliever. And that's not just an insult, but we need to understand the implication of that statement. Why are you worse, or why are you as bad as an unbeliever, an infidel? And this is as I pray, these are the kind of thoughts that were in my head. And also, based upon the importance of our words, if we say that we've experienced the life-changing gospel, if we say that with our words, and actions don't follow, there's something with our confession. Something wrong with it. You know, if we say that we've experienced a life-changing gospel, then by definition, that change of life should take place in our lives. Now, each to all differing degrees, right? We all have different struggles, we all have different experiences, we all have different starting points. But there should be a trend, right? That if we see God and recognize his generous love and mercy towards us, that should change our lives to the effect that it should be demonstrated and shown in our lives. So just to think about that, right? Like that's, to me, there's an argument that Paul is making here by that really sharp indictment saying that you've denied the faith and you're worse than an unbeliever in the face of God's uncompromising justice, right? That is our starting point. We all fall short. We all are guilty before the ultimate judge of the universe. And yet in Christ, we've been shown this generous love and forgiveness. How can that not change you? How can you say that you've experienced that and not come away changed for the better, changed to reciprocate that kind of love, not just to God, but also to your fellow man? And I am preaching at you, to you, but I'm not preaching at you, right? Like, I'm saying this to myself, that if this is the gospel that I say I believe in, then it logically follows that I would gradually mature more and more into that same generous love. And so I'm preaching to myself as well. It's a similar argument. You know, as I was preparing for this, I was reading, you know, James 2 came to mind. In James chapter 2, one of the lessons from that chapter is that real faith really works. And it's ironic that the context is very similar to Timothy. You know, here Paul is writing Timothy to care for those in need, specifically widows. In James chapter 2, he talks about faith really working in the context of people showing favoritism to rich and disregarding the poor. It's interesting that that's the example he uses. And so a significant fruit of faith, if I can call it that, that's consistent with the gospel, consistent with the object of our faith, would be generosity to those in need. It would be care for the poor. It would be justice for those not represented. It would be defense for those who cannot help themselves, right? Is that not consistent with some of the verses that I read, that God is a defender of the fatherless and the widows and the orphans, those that ultimately really need help? I want to read a couple more verses. Again, that it's throughout the Bible. Deuteronomy 10, verses 18 and 19. And there's a logical flow here that I'm going to explain a little bit more. The Lord administers justice for the fatherless and the widow, and loves the stranger, giving him food and clothing. Therefore, love the stranger, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. That is the command among the many that God gave to his people. And they sorely disobeyed in that respect. Often, again and again, throughout the prophets, we see this indictment against God's people that they would take advantage of the poor, that they would take advantage of those that couldn't defend themselves, particularly those that were orphans and widows. And one of these indictments comes through the mouth of Ezekiel, where God inspires Ezekiel to say, and this is about Jerusalem. Okay, so consider this. Jerusalem is a place where God has chosen to place his name, a very special city to represent. If you want to talk about a city on a hilltop that was supposed to represent God's character and God's people, it was supposed to be Jerusalem. And look at this comparison that God speaks through Ezekiel. He says, as I live, says the Lord, neither your sister Sodom, he's comparing Jerusalem to Sodom, neither your sister, and even more so, he's talking about Sodom being better than Jerusalem. So neither your sister Sodom nor her daughters have done as you and your daughters have done. And he says this, look, this was the iniquity of your sister Sodom. When we think of Sodom, we often think of like violence and like gross sexual morality. But consider this first. This is a stepping stone to that point. This is the iniquity. This is the sin of your sister Sodom. She and her daughter had pride, fullness of food, and abundance of idleness. It almost sounds like those young women in the church of Ephesus. Neither did she strengthen the hand of the poor and needy. And they were haughty and committed abomination before me. Therefore, I took them away as I saw fit. The issue of their pride, their fullness of food, their selfishness, their luxurious, extravagance kind of way of living led to, and maybe was part of, the disregard, the ill treatment, the taking advantage of the poor and the needy. And it led to violence and sexual morality and all that kind of stuff. And that arrogance is what really caught me here. And it reminded me of a phrase from a song that I heard that goes like this, even the air that we breathe is a gift that we think we're entitled to. And I say these words not as a guilt trip, but rather to point us back to the grace that we have been shown. Again, Deuteronomy 10:18, consider the logical flow of how God provides this command to his people through Moses. He says, this is who I am, the Lord, this is my nature, this is the expression of my nature that I give to you, and so you should live likewise. I administer justice for the fatherless and the widow, and I love the stranger, giving him food and clothing. Therefore, right, in the same respect that we've experienced the generous love of God through Christ, therefore, we should love the stranger, for we were strangers in the land of Egypt. We were in bondage to sin and set free. And so, not a guilt trip, but rather a reminder that we'd reflect again and again on the love of God, and that should move us to help other people. To conclude, I want to read just a few references of individuals that have come to my mind that I would argue have been gripped by the gospel to either defend the defenseless or to care for those who couldn't care for themselves. One individual, her name is Dorcas or Tabitha, and we can read about her in Acts 9:36. Very few words just describing this lady. And I don't know if she was a widow or not, it doesn't say. But in Acts 9:36, it summarizes her life as full of good works and charitable deeds. Full of good works and charitable deeds. And then a couple verses later, in verse 39, it seems to imply that she cared for many widows by providing them clothing. And here is a woman who knew God and knew the heart of God, and her life manifestly served other people, in particular, it seems, in this case, widows, by making them clothing and caring for them. Maybe a more, much later in history, but not yet a modern example, but one other individual that came to mind was William Wilberforce. He was a member of the British Parliament. Late 1700s, early 1800s, was extremely integral to the abolition of the Atlantic slave trade. He was someone that just pushed for, again, gripped by the gospel, gripped by the God that he loved, and realizing God's heart for defending these people who were essentially kidnapped from their homes and sold as animals, and wrestled with that, and leveraging his political position to basically free those people, you know, stop that disgusting slave trade. And there's so much more that we can read about him and the next person, another person, George Mueller, another British believer. He cared for literally thousands of orphans, built orphanages, built schools to raise people up out of their poverty. This other individual, Charles Mulley, I had a chance to actually hear him speak in person. And it's just, I don't know, it feels like it's, not to be sacrilegious, but like to compare him to the Apostle Paul or someone like that, it just seems like you're watching a person speak that there seems to be such a gap. Like, do I believe the same gospel that this person believes in? Have I experienced the love of God in the same way that this person has? Because the way that they live is just dramatically different than my life. And maybe that's not a proper comparison to make, but nevertheless, I can't help but make it. And Charles Mulley was an abandoned orphan who lived in Kenya, Africa. Before he was abandoned, suffered the violence of his drunken father, who would often come home at night and beat his wife beat his mother and him. He was the oldest boy. The other kids didn't seem to get it as bad. But that was his starting point. And I'm forgetting at what age, maybe around the age of 16 or so, through the invitation of a friend, became a believer, to a church event, became a believer. Hard worker, bright kid, unfortunately didn't have the education that he wanted to pursue, but became an entrepreneur, businessman, literally a story from rags to riches. Very wealthy, millionaire. And eventually sold all that he had so that he could take care of, quite literally, the fatherless, the other orphans, the same people who grew up in the same kind of, and suffered the same way that he did as a child. And you just read these stories that, again, I have to ask, how has the gospel shaped my perspective, you know, my life, in terms of how I interact with people that I see in need? The last person I want to mention was, his name is Lee Jong-rak. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing it, but he's a South Korean pastor. And there's a documentary on what he did. It's called The Dropbox. Actually, there's a documentary on Charles Mulley called Mulley. And there's a book, too, called A Father to the Fatherless. But nevertheless, back to Lee Jong-rak. He's a South Korean pastor who saw just kids abandoned on the streets, essentially left to die, right? Maybe they were deformed. Maybe they were, had some sort of mental condition. The mother didn't want to suffer the embarrassment of having a child out of wedlock, or they couldn't financially didn't want to take care of the child, or whatever it was, right? There's this growing issue of abandoned children. And so I think he kind of built it into the side of his church, this little drop box, where parents or mothers could leave their unwanted child instead of being left to die. And like, I don't think these people necessarily knew what they were doing was going to become. They just kind of were doing it one step at a time, like maybe one child, one baby, or whatever it was at a time, maybe just one person at a time. And then, you know, it blows up because I think God uses those that really avail themselves to his service. And so I just want to list some of these examples, not to shame myself or you in any respect, but rather as examples to look up to, you know, something that we can maybe set our trajectory on to, like, you know, I want to model my life more like these people who were really gripped by the gospel. I want to model my life more like people who avail themselves to God's work as opposed to whatever it is that distracts us otherwise. You know, we don't all need to start orphanages, but we all need to help, obviously. And so based on the letter or the passage that we read that Paul wrote to Timothy, you know, it starts in our families, that we'd care for our own, but it quickly goes beyond that. And so I think the question, or rather the challenge that I leave for you as well as myself, is to ask God to show us who and how we can help those around us who are in need. I'll close with the words of Jesus. This is a parable of the sheep and the goats. It might be familiar to some of you. Matthew 25, verses 34 through 36. Then the king will say to those on his right hand, that is the sheep, "Come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me."